following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
And now for part two of John Cutter's interview with Everett D. Reamer, author of Unconquerable Faith, Surviving Corregidor, Bataan, and Japan. Once again, here's John Michael Cutter and his guest, Everett D. Reamer.
So we get to Taipei on Formosa, and we're taken off the ship. And we were on the dockside, and we were hosed down with fire hoses, which felt good, really, because we had not had a bath in weeks. And so it was, it felt good. So we then went up out of Taipei to a cove and stayed up there for a number of days. I don't know for what reason. And a number of our guys were still dying every day on board ship, and they would be buried over, put overboard, you know.
Because basically you were still being starved in the holes of these ships.
Yeah. But I managed during that period of time to stay up on the main deck. I ended up down in the hold a couple of times, but I was up forward on this ship. And the Japanese used to get a big kick out of any rice that they had left over from their feeding. If you've ever seen chickens fed in a chicken yard, you would know they would take it, a handful of their rice, and they'd toss down to us down below from the bridge area of this ship. And we would fight and scramble just like a bunch of chickens would to get a grain of rice. And this went on for, you know, all during that voyage. And eventually we ended up, we left the Philippines in early October, as I said. And on November 8th, we pulled into the port of Busan, Korea. And there, 1,600 of our guys got off. And I found out later they ended up in Mukden, Manchuria. And about 400 of us stayed on board ship and ended up going on to Japan, arriving there November 11th, 1942.
And I know it sounds odd to say that you were fortunate that that happened, but again, people need to understand that Korea, Manchuria, this is the end of the year. This is in winter months in freezing cold weather with troops that are still in jungle and summer gear.
True, and many died. They told me that the people that ended up there after the war, I found out that many of them died that first winter, and they could not bury them because the ground was so hard. And they stacked them up like cordwood, they said.
Mm-hmm. Just horrible. So you finally make it to the mainland of Japan.
Osaka.
Osaka. And you're then confined to a military prison.
Yes, well, a POW camp that was right on the waterfront area that had just been built. The conditions there were somewhat better. We had bays and shelving, three shelves on each side of the room, and, of course, no beds and no pillows to speak of, but a couple of cotton blankets. And so there we worked unloading ships in the harbor and working in warehouses and sometimes in steel mills and so forth. But it was a long, hard life. The Japanese treated us with bitter hatred. I never ever received any kind words or kind interaction from them. And so this went on until 1944, and I was starving, and all of our group was starving. And this this camp had about 500 to 600 British soldiers that had been captured at Hong Kong, Singapore, and so forth. So they dominated the camp, and there was approximately 200 of us Americans in this facility. So a group of us got together and decided we were going to. Red Cross food parcels had been issued to us two times in 4 years. And the Japanese, there was a storeroom directly across from where our room was. We could see the Japanese coming in and taking these supplies. And so a group of eight of us got together and decided we were going to take what was rightfully ours. And so we got together and drew straws, and you might know I drew the short straw. And so it was my job to go into the storeroom. We had a guy that was working in a foundry that made a key that fit the lock. And I don't know whether he had been a locksmith prior to this or not, but he made the key. And at night, we had to have one of our own men stand guard to make sure that no one, more than one guy left the room at a time to go to the toilet. So the guy that was in on it, he stood guard, went around and unlocked the door that was adjacent to the toilets. And when he came back, I had been standing guard for him while he was gone. I went around and got in, got two parcels out and into the toilet. No sooner did that, the Japanese, I could hear them coming on the run. Ended up, there was about six guards that was just between me and where this storeroom was, and they were in a heated discussion. And I decided I better make a move, and so I did make a move, and I walked in back of them between the fence and the end of the building. And I almost got to my room when I could hear them coming after me. So I went into the room and got to my place, but they knew I had gone into this room, so they questioned the guy that was standing guard, and he wouldn't, of course, say anything. So they beat him to a pulp, blacked his eyes, and just nearly killed him. So this went on the following day, and nothing had happened. And 2 days later, what they decided the Japanese would always do, they cut the food off to the group that they suspected of any situation that they might be agreeing with whatever.
And food's a relative term.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Food amounted to how much?
How much and how often.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of what you were given to eat during that period of time, and legitimately, you're already starved, you're in a forced labor situation, and what are they giving you as a ration at that point?
Well, we were getting equivalent to about 1,000 calories a day, is what they said, which the hard manual work that we were performing, most of us were continually losing weight. So anyway, they cut the food off to our room for 2 days. And so I went then to the chief boatswain's mate that had been captured on Guam, who was technically in charge of we Americans there. And told him, I said, look, it was me and this other guy that had been standing guard. I didn't include the other six. And I thought by incorporating two, they wouldn't kill both of us, you know. So anyway, I said, do whatever you have to do, but try to get our group fed. And there had been no pressure from the other people in the room, in our room, to do this. And so I then went back to the room, and the following morning we fell out for work, and we were singled out, me and this other fellow. And then we started being tortured and questioned and had the water treatment like you hear so much about. Had a fire extinguisher shoved, tied to a bench, and had a fire extinguisher rammed into our mouth and then water pumped into our lungs. And beaten, of course. And then we were forced to stand at attention and without food or water. This was on a Tuesday morning, and on Sunday night, I finally passed out.
So from Tuesday morning till Sunday night, you stood at attention.
In front of a group of guards.
Without food, water, or relief.
Right.
And then not only stood at attention, but the threat was that if you broke attention, you'd be beaten.
I'd be killed.
If you fell out of attention, you'd be killed. Yeah,
right,
so
exactly.
So you were routinely beaten while you were still standing at attention.
And Lord only knows you try your best to hold up as long as you can. But unbeknown to me at the time, two British soldiers that was nearby rushed in and picked me up and carried me back to their quarters. And also this other guy that was still standing, he was taken back. And they defied the Japanese. They would not turn us back over to the Japanese.
And at this point in time, you were 17 years old.
I was 17. So the following morning, the Japanese came back and wanted us again, and the British told them that if they didn't start feeding us and giving us water, that they would not turn us back over to them. So they agreed, the Japanese, to start feeding us. So they gave us a few spoons full of rice and gave us some water. And then we would stand at attention each morning. We would be out in front of the guards before the guys would go out the main gate. And we'd stand there all day until they returned at night. and then we would be taken in and put into a little quartered room adjacent to the guards. And that went on for 28 days.
And not because of that, but because of the first torture session between Tuesday and Sunday, you still hold the Guinness Book of World's Records for being forced to stand motionless longer than any other human being.
That is true, 132 hours.
And, you know, the other thing is, too, we're talking about limited food issues. 1,000 calories, just in perspective of all that, it takes 2,000 calories a day just to keep bodily processes functioning at a normative level. You're reduced to half of that, and then caused to work, then caused to be beaten. Just extraordinary deprivation after everything's said and done. Just amazing. But that wasn't the end of it, was it?
No. After 20, on September the 18th, 1944, we had a typhoon, and our camp was kind of up at a higher elevation than the surrounding area and the dock area. Water had come in and was all around this camp area. So we were, two guards came. They took their shoes off and put them around our neck. And we walked through this water until we hit dry land. And we were march down the streets of Osaka, not knowing where we were going or what was going to happen to us. And I never will forget, I saw this German that was off of a German freighter out in the harbor. There was two of them, and they looked over at us and started laughing. And I, being of German background, I never wanted to kill two Germans so bad in all my life. But anyway, we were marching. We ended up at Army headquarters in Osaka, what they call Chumagum. And there was three Japanese officers that were sitting on a bench. And they questioned us, and we had an interpreter. And I explained to them that the Japanese had been taking the supplies that were intended for us POWs, and that something should be done about it, and so forth. And so after questioning for a period of time, they asked me who I thought was going to win the war. And I felt like saying, "You bastards certainly aren't." But I dared not say that, and so I said, "I'm an American, and it's only natural for me to think that the Americans will win the war." And he accepted that without any harsh comment and so forth. And so then we were handcuffed and blindfolded and marched from the building. And I thought, for sure, whenever they blindfold you, usually it means death. And I thought we were going to be taken out and shot, probably. But we ended up on what appeared to be a train, because you get to hear the wheels and the sound of motion and so forth. And we ended up, after some period of time, getting off the train and then taken walking, not still knowing where we were going, and ended up with the hood removed and so forth. And here we were inside this prison called Osaka Sakai Prison. And there we were issued red pajama-type bottoms and a top, no shoes, and we were marched across the prison into the compound where the cells were, and there we were put in individual cells. I ended up in cell number 13. It was there was no heat, no running water, concrete floor to lay on, and a wooden pail for a toilet.
This is approximately 3 years after the beginning of the war.
True.
Mm-hmm. So we've survived Corregidor. We've survived being almost killed by our own forces in the hell ships. You've survived being in a forced labor camp, being tortured, being beaten, and now you find yourself in a what can be called a formal military prison in solitary confinement.
True. And we get there in September and November and December, and it was real cold in the winter of 44 and 45. My hands and feet froze. And so my hand became infected, frostbite, my right hand, and I used to hold it up under my armpit to keep it warm. So finally, it got so bad that I knew that I wouldn't live. My arm was swelling and turning black, And so I decided that I'm going to lay down. We weren't permitted to lay down or exercise in the cell at any time. There was no chairs, no benches, nothing in there other than the floor and the walls. They had a meeting for all of the Japanese prisoners that was in there. And I managed, we had a small window up out of the back of the cell that was barred. And I managed, and my friend was two doors down, two cells over from me. And so I managed this time to yell through this back window of the cell that I was in bad shape. And so I wanted to communicate with him and tell him that if I didn't make it, he could visit my family after the war. And he told me his address. I had not known his address prior to that time. He was from Ralston, Oklahoma. And so we both agreed that in the event one, and I told him I was going to start laying down and that there would be hell to pay for having done that. They may kill me and so forth. And so I started laying down, and they would open the cell door, the guards would, and kick me. And the cell door was solid wood. You couldn't tell who was outside, looking in through a little slot that they had in the door. And so this one day, a fellow spoke through this screen slot, and he said, "What is your problem?" in perfect English. And I said, "My hands are frozen, my feet are frozen, and if I don't get help, I'm going to die." So he called down then for the fellow that was in charge of the cell block and had him come up and unlock my door. So when he unlocked the door, it was a big, he was the administrator for this prison. He was the warden. And he ordered them to take me over to the first aid area. I was barefooted now. There was snow on the ground. I walked through the snow over to this aid area. And there, two guys held me down while this old Japanese doctor lanced my infected hand and actually saved it, really, saved my life, really. And then I was marched back to the cell again.
And we're in a period of time when modern antibiotics are 4 to 10 years old. There was penicillin, there was sulfanilamide, and that was about it.
True.
Just amazing. It's hard to imagine what possibly sustains you through these kind of periods of time. But tell our listeners the story of your aunt and her Bible.
Well, my aunt, who lived in San Francisco, was a missionary and worked in the mission district of San Francisco. During my stay in San Francisco, I had visited her. She was a real religious person, and she had sent me a Bible, a New Testament Bible, and had written, inscribed in there, that whenever you feel a need and feel down, refer to the Bible and its contents. It will help you get through any situation. And so I had this Bible on Corregidor, and I had decided when the battle knew eventually that the Japanese were going to attack the island of Corregidor, and I would have to be fighting hand-to-hand. So I had buried a new clean uniform and had put this Bible in the pocket of my shirt, hoping that upon the invasion of Corregidor proper, I would be able to change into clean clothes and go into battle, which was rather foolish of me to think that. And so the night that I was ordered to go to get my infantry gear and go into a battle mode, I didn't have time to change into this clothing, this clean clothing. But months later, after having arrived at Osaka Camp 1, the fella came up to me and he handed me this Bible. He said, "Here, I think this belongs to you." And so I didn't think to get his name. I didn't think to ask him how he managed to find that in this dugout hole that I had put it in up in, up at my battery position on Corregidor. But when I ended up going into solitary, of course, I lost it again.
Just a remarkable story.
And during the period of time that I was in solitary, I mean, it was a day-to-day existence. I never knew that whether I would wake up the following morning or not. And I said to myself, the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want."
For prisoners who gave up, for prisoners, and I mean give up by losing all hope, losing all faith, How long did it take them to reach that point and then just be gone altogether?
Usually within 10 days.
10 days.
They would be gone.
Just amazing. Just amazing.
And a number of them did that.
And at this point, you're relatively cut off from all communication. You have no idea whether your side is winning, losing the war. All you know is the day-by-day, hour-by-hour existence of your solitary confinement.
That's pretty much true. Although, in solitary, about once a month, we would be permitted to go out into the prison yard and walk in a circle. And we had eight civilians that walked in the circle with us. There were eight Allied military POWs in prison, in solitary, five Americans, two Brits, and one Dutch. And in the civilian area, there were two Russians, two Germans, two Dutch, one French, and one guy that I could never figure out what country he was from. But all of these folks were in the import-export business in Japan. And they could speak several languages. And we did find out when the invasion of Okinawa occurred and how many ships was involved. Hmm. And but that was the first time that we really got any good information.
And Okinawa was to be the staging area for the possible invasion of the mainland of Japan as the European theater wound down and then eventually was won.
True.
I think it's important to understand, because there's been so much revisionist history attempted to be written surrounding the issue of the atomic bomb and the dropping of the atomic bomb. But as those forces were amassing on Okinawa, as Europe was finally coming out of the grips of that theater's occupation and the war and devastation that occurred there, the issue then became the fact that casualties started to mount horrendously in the Pacific theater, more so than ever had been in Europe. And at that point, we were still losing almost 2,000 individuals a day in the war effort, a day, compared to what we understand in today's modern conflicts. What about Truman's decision to drop the bomb?
This concludes Track 2, and now listen to Track 3, the last and final track of this three-part series, World War II, An American Hero. Unconquerable Faith, Surviving Corregidor, Bataan, and Japan, by Everett D. Reamer. His book is available and distributed worldwide through the media publishing group of Flypaper Productions. Available in paperback for $20, and in audiobook form in a set of two CDs for $30. These prices are in U.S. currency. As part of this special podcast offer, Flypaper Productions will include media shipping and handling at no additional charge. It's important to point out that at the author's election, 100% of the proceeds from sales of Unconquerable Faith, whether it be through this podcast or otherwise, are donated to the author's local Children's Learning Center, part of a 15-state program with a mission of teaching children to read. To order your copy of Unconquerable Faith, whether it's the print edition for $20 or the audiobook version for $30, make your check payable to Flypaper Productions and mail it to our distribution center at P.O. Box 324, Harrison, Ohio, 45030, USA.